So John chapter 11 is especially a familiar text to us. It is the seventh and final miracle, at least in John's record. We know that from John chapter 20, at the end, which we've looked at several times throughout our study, the purpose of this gospel being recorded by the Spirit, that Jesus did many other signs, but there are seven specific signs in the Gospel of John that are recorded especially as validation of Jesus' claims to be the Son of God. They bear witness to that claim as truth. They testify for us, and they are evidence provided for us to give us a reasonable faith and conviction that He is indeed the Son of God, the Messiah, that believing we may have life in His name. And while each miracle is by its very nature and by its very definition of what a miracle is, an incredible thing, certainly one that would incite faith in those who read this record with honesty, the miracles have somewhat progressed in how impressive they are, and we've pointed out some various things. The last miracle in John chapter 9 was the healing of a man that was born blind, and you might remember that the text speaks about how this has never happened, that a man would be born blind and would be healed. Verse 32, since the world began, it has been unheard of that anyone opened the eyes of him who was born blind. And so, as great as that was, in John chapter 11, we're going to see something even greater. This is not the only time, and I think we are very familiar with the context, hopefully we've read it already, that there's a resurrection of a dead man, Lazarus. And we're very familiar with this, but this isn't the only time Jesus raised someone from the dead. And it wasn't the only time anyone has raised someone from the dead. We read of even people in the Old Testament who are raised from the dead, like Elijah and Elisha raising people from the dead. But Jesus raises Lazarus from the dead, and we'll note some things that occur, really that Jesus allows to occur in regard to time, that would make this miracle even more impressive, as Lazarus had been 4 days dead and already starting to decay and stink, yet the Lord is master over death. He defeats it and would defeat it in His own death, in His resurrection, but also master over time. We saw when He healed the man's son that He didn't have to go to him, and He healed him from afar, that He was one who exhibited power over distance. Well, in John chapter 11, we'll see He has the power of life within Himself, the power to resurrect. But also, I'd suggest to you that there is a point we can draw from this, that He has power over time. It doesn't matter how much time has passed and how much bad has happened in that time. Jesus is not subject to time. So even though Lazarus had been dead 4 days, as we'll see, it didn't keep him from performing this miracle and raising him to life. You know, we also get from this the importance Jesus placed in doing His Father's will, no matter what the danger was that lie ahead. And we see that in this text because Bethany is the town where Mary, Martha, and their brother Lazarus lived, where Lazarus died and Jesus went to the grave and raised him from the dead. Bethany, as we'll see in verse 18, is near Jerusalem, about 2 miles away. And when Jesus said, "Let us go to Judea," the disciples said, "Lately the Jews sought to stone you, and you are going there again." So Jesus is going into the war zone, if you will, of the conflict He has with the Jewish leaders. But He has an opportunity to manifest His glory and to manifest the glory of God by raising Lazarus from the dead and convincing more souls that He is indeed the Messiah, the Son of God, so that believing they may have life in His name. And He has this opportunity, and He's not going to squander it. Yet, because it's so close to Jerusalem, it also provided a very quick way for the news to spread. And as we'll see at the end of this chapter, things further digress in the relationship between Jesus and the Jewish rulers. Really, truly, they've already deteriorated fully. The Jewish leaders are simply looking for an opportunity to execute a plan to arrest Jesus, ultimately to put him to death. And this would be a catalyst for that moment, if you will. So read with me in John chapter 11, verse 1. A certain man was sick, Lazarus of Bethany, the town of Mary and her sister Martha. It was that Mary who anointed the Lord with fragrant oil and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick. Therefore the sisters went out to him, saying, "Lord, behold, he whom you love is sick." So this is Lazarus, a different Lazarus than what we read of in Luke 16. Evidently, it was a very common name with the Jews. He was specifically the brother of Mary and Martha. Now, we haven't read of Lazarus or Mary and Martha up to this point. He mentions in verse 2 a situation, an occurrence that the church would be very familiar with. Remember, John is writing this gospel after the church has been established, after Jesus was raised from the dead. So after the fact, to give faith to others when they read about this story. And so people had already heard about Mary's act, and so he refers to it. But in chapter 12, he'll actually give the account, according to his gospel, of that happening. So this is Mary and Martha, and they are people who evidently were very close to Jesus, and Lazarus along with them. We read in Luke chapter 10 of Jesus being in the house of Mary and Martha, and Martha, remember, was distracted with serving, and Mary sat at the feet of Jesus. We remember that story vividly. Well, evidently, when Jesus was in town, he would stay with them quite often, and they would show him hospitality, and that gives occasion for great growth in relationships, and that's definitely what happened with Jesus, Mary, and Martha. And so this story gives some intimacy to it from this background knowledge. They sent messengers, apparently, or a messenger, sent the news to Jesus that Lazarus, whom you love, is sick. Now, Jesus heard that. He said in verse 4, "This sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God may be glorified through it." And this would have been within the hearing of this messenger. And so it's very likely that the messenger goes back with what Jesus said to Mary and Martha, which would give a better understanding of why they would say the things that they would say when Jesus appeared to them. And we'll note that. But he says it's not unto death. Now, he would purposely wait, and we'll see, for Lazarus to die. But that death would be overcome. This sickness is not just for Lazarus to die and be gone for good. This sickness was an opportunity that Jesus saw to manifest the glory of God and to manifest his glory as the only begotten Son of God. That's what he's suggesting. We might remember in chapter 9 some similar language when the disciples asked whether this man sinned or his parents sinned that he was born blind, and he said, "Neither, but that the works of God should be revealed in him." That's basically what Jesus is saying here. This is not unto death, but it is for the glory of God that the Son of God may be glorified through this miracle. So in verse 5, it says Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. And this is something that is one of those subtle but powerful things within the gospel record. It's showing Jesus' humanity. And we'll see that even more so when this love leads to a broken heart through the death of Lazarus and the mourning and sorrow of her sister, of his sisters and of all the Jews. Jesus was a man. And so you can even further, I think, appreciate that by the fact that he was doing these things and waiting during this time, and it wasn't easy for him. He was one who was a man of sorrows, as Isaiah 53 would suggest. But he loved them. But then he said, it says in verse 6, when he heard that he was sick, he stayed 2 more days in the place where he was. Now, one might scratch their heads at this if they weren't familiar with the text. It says he loved Mary and Martha. He loved Lazarus. He heard he was sick, but he waited 2 days. He waited 2 days after he heard he was sick. Why would he wait? It was a dangerous situation. If he loved them, why wouldn't he wait? Or why would he wait? And we see why in verse 15 when he says to his disciples, I'm glad for your sakes that I was not there, that you may believe. And so his delay showed love, I would suggest to you. It showed love because Jesus' wisdom that he possessed had the foresight of what would be the potential of spiritual growth in those who would witness a resurrection, not just a healing. And so Jesus waited. This will be more impressive. This will be more thought-provoking and faith-provoking if he dies and I raise him from the dead, instead of him just being healed. So keep that in mind. And verse 7, after this, he said to the disciples, let us go to Judea. Now this is when the disciples, as we alluded to before, kind of, they manifest their own human nature and the fact that they were still not understanding of the plan for Jesus to die, even though he's been somewhat clear about this throughout other synoptic gospel accounts prior to this event. But they're worried. There's a storm brewing in Judea, and you want to go there? They said, Rabbi, lately the Jews sought to stone you, and are you going there again? Now, the next verses with Jesus' reply are reminiscent of what we saw in John 9, and they're impressive. And so before we read them, remember in John 9, after he gave the answer that neither the parents nor this man sinned, but that the works of God should be revealed in him, he said in verse 4 of John 9, I must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. The night is coming when no one can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. Now keep that in mind and remember what we talked about in regard to that. When Jesus answered them and said in verse 9 of John 11, are there not 12 hours in the day? If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble because he sees the light of this world. But if one walks in the night, he stumbles because the light is not in him. And so Jesus is saying a very similar thing to what we just read in John chapter 9. And I think that it has pretty much the same meaning, yet maybe gives a little more depth to it. He mentions there's 12 hours in a day. And so you've got a limited amount of time. The sun is only up for so many hours in the day. And if you walk in the day, literally thinking about this figure, you walk in the day, you're not going to stumble. You're going to be able to see in front of you. And even if there is an object in front of you, you can walk around it, or maybe you can turn around and not run into it, or you can go over it. If you have light, you'll be able to see it, and you're not going to stumble. You can see it because you have the light of this world. The sun shines in the day. But if you were to walk in the night, you would stumble. You don't have light available to you. The light doesn't enter into your eye to where you can see what is in front of you. You have no ability to walk without danger. You'll stumble. I think he is pointing out two things. And of course, they're similar to what he said in John 9. He only has a limited amount of time. While it is day, he needs to work, he said in John 9. He says, here there's only 12 hours in a day. Now, where we may have a time of weakness where at the end of the day we have a little bit more time where we could use to get some work done, but we say, oh, I've done enough today, I'm going to stop. Jesus is saying, I've got to use it all. I've got to use every single second, every single hour I have. My time is drawing nigh. We've already made reference to that in regard to his time drawing nigh. And in chapter 12, the last week of his ministry before his death would begin. And so time is fading away for him, but he still has time. And so it's still day. He's still got to work while it's day. But not only that, he's going to do his Father's will, but being so close to Judea as the disciples were worried about, this would cause a lot of trouble for Jesus. Now, Jesus, though, isn't worried about that because it's day. It's not his time for night to draw near. It's his time to continue the works of God. So he's not worried about that. But if he decided, you know what, you're right, disciples. This is too close to Judea. Things are too sketchy right now. I'm going to stay. I'm not going to go and heal Lazarus. I'm not going to worry about this right now to avoid this conflict. then he would be avoiding the responsibility God has given him in the light of day, then putting away time that he couldn't buy back up. And when the night is coming, no man can work. And so Jesus has a responsibility to fulfill, and he's not going to shirk that responsibility. Remember in Ephesians 5 and verse 16, the Apostle Paul said that we must redeem the time because the days are evil. That's exactly what Jesus is demonstrating here. And not only that, he knows that if he's doing the Father's will and it's day, there's no way he'll stumble. There's safety in that understanding. And so these things he said, and after that he said to them, "Our friend Lazarus sleeps, but I go that I may wake him up." His disciples said in verse 12, "Lord, if he sleeps, he will get well." However, Jesus spoke of his death, but they thought that he was speaking about taking rest and sleep. They have some hope that Lazarus is going to be okay. And so when Jesus uses the common euphemism, sleep, for death, they didn't immediately think death. They just thought sleep. So Jesus gets further to the point in verse 14. He stated plainly, it says, "Lazarus is dead." And so sometimes we need to just have something stated to us plainly. That's what Jesus did. Lazarus is dead. Now, the interesting point is made in verse 15. Jesus said, "And I am glad for your sakes that I was not there, that you may believe. Nevertheless, let us go to him." He's glad. He's not glad because Jesus finds some kind of enjoyment in their sorrow, that Jesus was for some reason glad that Lazarus died in and of itself. Jesus cares not only about Lazarus and Mary and Martha, but about his disciples and everyone else in the world. He cares about us who are reading this. He cares about the Jews who will come and witness the resurrection of Lazarus. And this tells me something about the Son of God and about God and how God thinks. God cares more about the spiritual than the physical. He's going to care for us physically. He shows compassion for us physically. He provides for us physically. He takes pain away physically. He comforts us physically. Yet we still die. We still go through pain and heartache. We still struggle in the flesh. And we can take an object lesson from this, that as long as our inward man is being renewed day by day, as 2 Corinthians chapter 4 says, that's all that matters. And that's what Jesus was thinking here. Lazarus may die. You may go through immense sorrow at the time. But I'm glad I let him die, because when you see me raise him back to life, there's going to be a greater work spiritually that is processing in you as your faith grows. And that is much more important. And it makes the sorrow worth it in Jesus' eyes, because that sorrow would be swallowed up in joy and in faith in the Son of God, who could give them all a resurrection to life in the end. We'll talk about that in a minute. In verse 16, it says, "Thomas, who is called the twin, said to his fellow disciples, 'Let us also go that we may die with him.'" This is the same Thomas who in chapter 20 will not believe until he feels the scars of Jesus. And so we call him Doubting Thomas from time to time. Maybe we can call him Pessimistic Thomas. But don't give him too much of a bad rap, because I think Thomas is expressing what everyone else was thinking at this time. And I think everyone in chapter 20, they were still struggling to believe at that time. And so Thomas had to work with this and work against his pessimism. And he too would be moved to joy, no doubt, when Jesus resurrected Lazarus from the dead. So this is Jesus' discussion with his disciples and his decision to go to Judea, to Bethany, to ultimately, in his mind, raise Lazarus from the dead. They don't know what he's going to do, though. Well, in verse 17, it says Jesus came and found that he had already been in the tomb 4 days, that is Lazarus, and he came to Bethany, that was near Jerusalem, about 2 miles away. So again, close proximity to Jerusalem. But notice there, it mentions, and we'll mention again, that he was in the tomb 4 days already. So not only did he wait 2 days after he received the message and Lazarus died, but then he has to travel all the way to Judea, and that would take some time. So he gets there, and by the time he gets there, there's been 4 days passed since Lazarus died. In verse 39, it will note that he's already starting to decay. He's starting to stink. And this would manifest all the more the power and glory of God and the ability to overcome death even well after it had already occurred. In verse 18, it said, many Jews joined the women around Martha and Mary to comfort them concerning their brother. We'll note later in verses 45 and 46 that out of these Jews who came from the city that was 2 miles away from Bethany, there would be two reactions. So evidently there were some enemies of Jesus among this group, because although they would witness the resurrection, they would not believe in him, and instead they would go tell on Jesus to the Jewish authorities and hoping that Jesus would be put away ultimately. And that's exactly what would happen. They would plot against him. But these Jews are there, and this would set the stage furthermore for more to see this resurrection and more to understand who Jesus is. And I think all would understand, but only some would be believing, having that faith that would save. Others would refuse him, as we'll see. But here in this text, we see Jesus is being confronted by Martha, the sister of Lazarus and also of Mary. And it says, Martha, as soon as she heard that Jesus was coming, went and met him, but Mary was sitting in the house. And Martha said to Jesus, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But even now I know that whatever you ask of God, God will give you. So Mary didn't know yet that Jesus was there. Martha meets him first. And remember in verse 3 that they had sent someone with news to Jesus that said, Lord, behold, he whom you love is sick. So they wanted him to come because they knew that if he came, he could heal Lazarus. And that's what she expressed. She's not rebuking Jesus. She's just pouring out with sorrow. She's not blaming Jesus. She knew the political climate and the climate against Jesus in Jerusalem. And she knew it would be difficult for him to get there in time before Lazarus died anyway. And so she's not blaming Jesus. She's just sorrowful. But she still expresses a measure of faith in saying, I know that whatever you ask of God, God will give you. And so she doesn't know necessarily what Jesus might do, what he might ask of God, but she has the faith that Jesus has an ability, a relationship with God that is close enough where God would hear him and God would give whatever he asks of him. You know, we might note that perhaps her words demonstrate a slight misunderstanding in who Jesus was and his relationship to the Father. Asking or suggesting that Jesus would ask God and God would give him, when in reality, Jesus has the power within himself. And I think that would especially be demonstrated when he prays in verses 41 and 42. He doesn't ask God to raise Lazarus from the dead. That decision's already been made. He just thanks God that he hears his prayers so that others could hear that and understand his relationship with the Father as he is his son. And so maybe that's just a side point. But Jesus said to her, your brother will rise again. And she said, I know that he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day. So as we read throughout the scriptures, especially when Paul in Acts is giving his defense of himself before the Jews and Agrippa, he speaks about how he's judged for the hope that the Jews have, of the hope of the fathers. And that hope is of the resurrection. He tells Agrippa, why should it be thought incredible that God raises the dead? That's the hope they had. That's the belief they had. And that's what Martha ultimately is referring to. Jesus said, your brother will rise again. What she was thinking is in the resurrection in the end. In John chapter 5, he speaks about how all will be raised from the dead, both the just and the unjust, some to life, and then others to condemnation. She believes that Lazarus will rise again that day. What she didn't understand at this point is that Jesus is not talking about that day, although that is true. Lazarus would eventually die again. He would not be raised this time to die no more. Only Jesus would do that. And he would be raised in the end after his second death. But Jesus is talking about now. He'll be raised now. So Jesus said, I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me, though he may die, he shall live. And whoever lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this? So it's as if he's saying, Martha, yes, he will be raised in the end, but I'm here right now and I am the power to raise. in the future. And if I'm the power and I'm here right now, he can be raised right now. I am the resurrection and the life. The power is here. The ability is here. You don't have to wait until that day. That's his understanding. That's what he's planning to do. But we need to be impressed by this, that he is the resurrection and the life. In John chapter 5, we might remember in verse 21, he explained, as the Father raises the dead and gives life to them, even so the Son gives life to whom he will. And he speaks about a spiritual resurrection and then a physical resurrection, or a bodily resurrection rather, in the end, a universal bodily resurrection. And kind of references those as well here. He says, he who believes in me, that's faith, spiritual, though he may die physically, because it's appointed for man to die once, he shall live. So the individual who has faith in Christ may die physically. In fact, they will die physically unless the Lord comes before then. But they'll conquer that death. They will live. Similarly, in verse 26, he says, whoever lives, whoever's alive and believes in me, that is, there's the spiritual faith, shall never die. So you live now, but you'll never die. And he's not contradicting his previous statement, you will die, but in a sense you won't die. Because in John chapter 6, we might remember when he was speaking about being the bread of life and the Father has given some to him, and what he has been given to him, he will by no means lose. He says in verse 39, this is the will of the Father who sent me, in John 6, verse 39, that of all he has given me, I should lose nothing, but should raise it up at the last day. He won't lose those who believe in him. They're not going to be forgotten. Death is not going to take them where they'll never see Jesus again. And verse 47, he says, most assuredly, I say to you, he who believes in me has everlasting life. And so present tense has everlasting life. And we emphasized that when we studied John chapter 6, that they have eternal life now. It'll be consummated in the end. And they're in a time where through disobedience and lack of faith, they could lose that eternal life, but they have it now. Now, what Jesus is saying is obviously contingent upon that faithfulness until death. Though you may die, you will live. And if you live spiritually by believing in me, you will never die. You may die physically, but that can't take away your spiritual life. So Jesus is the resurrection and the life. Those who put their faith in him, therefore, are secured in their spiritual life and in their hope of life after death. So she said to him after he asked, do you believe this? Yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God who has come into the world. So she expresses her faith in him being the Messiah, the Son of God, but she probably doesn't fully understand that he was pointing out he's going to raise Lazarus from the dead now. And I think we can see that a little bit further on when she says, Lord, by this time there is a stench, for he has been dead 4 days, when he says to take away the stone. And so she's not fully getting it yet, but she still has faith in him. She trusts in him. It kind of, as a side point, reminds me of Abraham, as his faith is demonstrated in Hebrews 11, how he was concluding that God was going to raise his son Isaac from the dead, and he received him like that in a figurative sense, but that was never God's intention. He was testing Abraham, and Abraham offered Isaac up in that way, but Isaac never died, and God never had to raise him from the dead. So that wasn't the Father's will, but Abraham had enough faith to carry on with his obedience at that time, knowing God could reverse the death of his son and therefore follow through with his promises. And similarly, Martha isn't fully understanding what Jesus is saying here, but she believes that he is the Christ, the Son of God, and so he has that power, and she's going to follow him faithfully because of that. So Martha confronts Jesus and talks with him, and it said Mary, remember, didn't know he was there, so then he speaks with Mary in this next section. After she had said these things, she went her way secretly and called Mary, her sister, saying, the teacher has come and is calling for you. And as soon as she heard that, verse 29, she arose quickly and came to him. Now Jesus had not yet come into the town, but was in the place where Martha met him. Then the Jews who were with her in the house and comforting her, when they saw that Mary rose up quickly and went out, followed her, saying, she is going to the tomb to weep there. So it says that Martha told Mary secretly. Other translations say privately, and that may just be an indication that she was in a private room and she just went to Mary and spoke in such a way that no one would have been able to hear except Mary. But I want us to note that Jesus had not yet come into town. He was at the place where Martha had met him. And when the Jews saw Mary leave the house, not knowing she was going to see Jesus, they just assumed that she was going to the grave. And that's because burial sites were always outside the city, and that's where Jesus was. So she was going to Jesus, but they thought she was going to the burial. And that to weep. And so as they were there to comfort, it says that later on they followed her. And so they would be given to witness this resurrection as well. Verse 31, they saw that she got up and followed her. She is going to the tomb to weep there. It may be, though, that Martha told her in secret because she knew there were enemies of Jesus and didn't want them to know that he was there. Regardless, those enemies, at least some of them, would be present, I think, by the providence of God, to witness this resurrection of Lazarus. And they would have to come to terms with its implications. Verse 32, when Mary came where Jesus was and saw him, she fell down at his feet, saying to him, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. Saying something similar to Martha, not rebuking him, but expressing her sorrow. And it kind of shows the difference in personality, where Martha seemed to be a little less emotional in this, though certainly she was emotional. Mary fell down at his feet. Therefore, when Jesus saw her weeping and the Jews who came with her weeping, he groaned in the spirit and was troubled. It said that he said, where have you laid him? And they said to him, Lord, come and see. And Jesus wept. I want us to pause there. I know that you've probably heard many times it said before, the shortest verse in the Bible is John chapter 11, verse 35, Jesus wept. But let me suggest to you that that doesn't mean anything. It doesn't matter what the shortest verse in the Bible is. It doesn't matter what the longest verse in the Bible is. People like to point out what the center verse in the Bible is, somewhere in the Psalms, all that kind of stuff. That's kind of more like what the Pharisees did in counting letters. That's how they took the law, that if they knew the exact amount of words within a text or whatever it was, what was the middle verse, things like that, that really didn't mean anything. They thought that made them more spiritually minded. That doesn't mean anything, that Jesus wept is the shortest verse in the Bible. The great significance that Jesus wept and groaned in his spirit because of his sorrow and because he was troubled is the humanity of Jesus. He was a man of sorrows. And that can comfort us, because if we've ever been through any kind of sorrow, Jesus has been through that sorrow in one way or another as well. And Jesus coped with it. He endured it. It never pushed him to any sin like it did with Job's wife. Curse God and die, she told him in her sorrow and in her struggle with those trials and tribulations. Jesus wept. And it tells us that it's okay for us to weep. It's human nature. It's how God created us. But as we see in 1 Thessalonians 4, it's okay for us to sorrow, but not sorrowing as others who have no hope. Jesus is the resurrection and the life. And I think we can see that in here, some validity to this. He wept because he loved Lazarus and he's sad that he died. He wept because he's seeing Mary and Martha, whom he loved, overwhelmed in anguish of spirit. And so that sorrows him all the more. But then he moves towards something. He's going to fix the problem. And so it's similar to what we read in 1 Thessalonians 4. Don't sorrow as others who have no hope, for we believe that those who sleep in Jesus will be raised and caught up to meet the Lord with us in the air, and we will forever be with the Lord. We don't have to sorrow as those who have no hope, because we are followers of Jesus, who is the resurrection and the life. But as we sorrow, we can take comfort in the fact that Jesus was a man of sorrows. And he's our high priest. And he can sympathize in our weaknesses. And he can encourage us. And he can give us what we need to get through those difficult times. So Jesus wept is indeed a powerful verse. And I think even in verse 36, we see how powerful it is. The Jews said in John 11:36, "See how he loved him." And some of them said, "Could not this man who opened the eyes of the blind also have kept this man from dying?" I think this gives us a preview into verse 44 and 45 and verse 46, where those Jews, evidently, some of them were enemies of Jesus, and while they would witness the resurrection, some would believe and some would go tell on Jesus so that he could be destroyed ultimately. Well, here when they saw him weeping and manifesting his sorrow and his love and his concern for Mary and Martha and Lazarus who died, there were two very opposite reactions. One reaction was they were impressed that Jesus loved him so much because they had known about Jesus's miracles, about his wisdom manifest in his speech and the authority that he spoke with. They knew, whether they believed or not, that he was the Son of God and the Messiah. They knew him to be a great prophet at the very least. He did some impressive things, yet this impressive and powerful man is overwhelmed with sorrow for lowly Lazarus, and that's impressive. Definitely the greatest thing that Jesus manifested in his ministry and in his life on earth was his love for mankind. But then others were skeptical, and they criticized him perhaps. If he's so powerful, couldn't he have healed Lazarus? Why didn't he come here? If he loved him so much, why didn't he come this far? He healed the blind man. Why couldn't he heal Lazarus from his illness? So two very opposed reactions. And that foreshadows the reaction to the actual miracle of Lazarus being raised from the dead. And so he speaks with Mary and Martha. And then he says, "Where have you laid him?" And so Jesus then will raise Lazarus in the next section. It said, again groaning in himself, Jesus came to the tomb in verse 38. It was a cave, and a stone lay against it. And Jesus said, "Take away the stone." And this is when Martha, the sister of Lazarus, who was dead, said to him, "Lord, by this time there is a stench, for he has been dead for 4 days." So the stone rolled in front of the door, as would be with Jesus' death and his burial, would keep out grave robbers. It would keep out creatures and critters. It would preserve, but keep the body sealed to where the dishonor of a dead body would be put away. And so this great stone would be hiding the stench. It would be keeping the stench away from those who would be around the tomb. And if Jesus rolls this stone away, everyone's going to smell the stench of Lazarus's dead body. In 1 Corinthians 15, it says, "The body is sown and dishonor, and it is raised in honor." Our body ultimately is a dishonorable thing in regard to how it is corruptible, and it's subject to decay and stench, like here. And there's a reason why we bury dead bodies, because a dead body is dishonorable. It's unclean. We've got to get rid of it because it's nasty. We don't live with dead bodies. We put them away. And that's what Martha's thinking. Don't want to disrespect or dishonor my brother who has passed away. Let's just keep him in there. And she's obviously not understanding what Jesus had said before about raising Lazarus from the dead. So there's obvious misunderstanding here. And Jesus kind of calls her on that, and he's trying to incite faith in her. He's trying to bring faith out of her, and he says, "Did I not say to you in verse 40 that if you would believe, you would see the glory of God?" Now, he didn't say that directly necessarily, but remember he said, "I am the resurrection and the life. Do you believe this?" And not only that, but in the hearing most likely of the messenger that said, "Lord, behold, he whom you love is sick," he said, "This sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God may be glorified through it." So perhaps they had heard from that as well. And Jesus said, "You're going to see the glory of God if you believe in me." Do you remember that? And so he persists. They took away the stone from the place where the dead man was lying. And Jesus lifted up his eyes and prayed, as we'll get to. And so evidently Martha consented. She caught on to a degree. "Okay, Lord, I do believe you. I don't know what you're about to do, but I believe you." And so rolled away the stone, and that's what happened. So Jesus lifted up his eyes in verse 41 and said, "Father, I thank you that you have heard me. And I know that you always hear me, but because of the people who are standing by, I said this that they may believe that you sent me. It wasn't necessary for Jesus to pray here in order to raise Lazarus from the dead. Evidently, there's an implication when he says, I thank you that you have heard me, they had already said a prayer. And so this was something that was according to God's will. That was manifested earlier in John chapter 11 when he said that it is the day and I, as the light of the world, must go. And so this was the Father's will that Lazarus be raised from the dead. But Jesus points out, I'm saying this with an earshot of everyone else that they will know you sent me. If a man prays to God, and then that man does what he's about to do in raising this man from the dead, that means as the man healed from his blindness indicated in John 9, God doesn't hear the prayers of sinners, and he healed my blindness. That this man Jesus is at least in a very special relationship with God. And in his prayer, he addresses him, not our Father, but Father, more personal. This is his Father. He's the only begotten Son of this Father, God. And he's saying this with an earshot of all the people so that they can have that measure of faith. So when he had said these things, verse 43, he cried aloud with a loud voice, Lazarus, come forth. And he who had died came out, bound hand and foot with grave clothes, and his face was wrapped with a cloth. And Jesus said to them, loose him and let him go. So Lazarus was raised from the dead. Very simple. Lazarus, come forth. Remember in John 5, the spiritual life that was given is from hearing the voice. And then in the end, the universal resurrection, all who are in their graves will hear my voice and come forth, some to the resurrection of life, those who are good, and some to the resurrection of condemnation, those who are evil. Just takes the voice of the Son of God. And that's what happened. And he was bound because of the custom of binding the limbs so that they're not hanging around when they bury the man. And they loosed him and let him go, according to Jesus' words. So what an incredible thing, the seventh miracle of Jesus. And what faith that gives us, that Jesus has power over death. It will be ultimately demonstrated in his own resurrection, because while God raises him from the dead and the Spirit of holiness raises him from the dead, remember in John chapter 10, he said, I lay down my life. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down on myself, and I have the power to lay it down and the power to take it again. So Jesus would be raised from the dead by his own power as well, but demonstrated here in the resurrection of Lazarus. What great power. And what faith that incites in us. And evidently, as we see in verse 45, some came to a measure of faith. We'll see in chapter 12 that there were those among the rulers who believed in him, but because of the Pharisees, they did not confess him, lest they should be put out of the synagogue, for they loved the praise of men more than the praise of God. Maybe that's some of these people here. It says, many of the Jews who had come to Mary and had seen the things Jesus did believed in him, but some of them went away to the Pharisees and told them of the things that Jesus did. And so how could there be two reactions to such an incredible thing? This man was not just dead. He had been dead 4 days and had started to stink. And there were some who believed and some didn't. That doesn't really add up to me. But that's really how this world is. Some men are just hard-hearted. And this is an object lesson to us. Faith is not simply seeing. Faith is faith. It's the belief and trust and evidence. And so he's still a man standing before them. This is Jesus of Nazareth standing before them. There's nothing about his physical appearance that has changed, but look what he just did. Now what does that indicate? Well, ultimately it does indicate that he is deity. But that's not right in your face. He's not transfigured before them, right? He's still a man. And so faith is something which comes from reason, as we talked about in the beginning, our introduction to John's gospel in our study. It follows reason. It doesn't necessarily allow with reason to prove what is impossible, but it believes that what is impossible has occurred by the evidence. And so faith is not simply seeing. And it also tells us that some are so hardened to the truth that the truth, no matter how plain it is not going to convince them. And that's what happened here. So doesn't matter how great our arguments are from the scripture, the truth is powerful enough by itself, regardless of how good we are in making an argument, to convince those who have the heart ready to receive God's word. And that just shows us that some will not believe because they don't want to believe. And it's not because the gospel is not powerful, it's because those men are obstinate. So in verse 47, after they had, some of them went away to the Pharisees to tell them about what Jesus did, it said the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered a council and said, "What shall we do? For this man works many signs. If we let him alone like this, everyone will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and nation." This tells me something. I think to this point, they know who Jesus is. They know. They know he's the Messiah. Now, they don't believe. They don't have faith. But they know that he's the Messiah. And that bears some implications for them, especially if they think that he's going to rule in a physical kingdom. Their place is going to be taken away. This belief of the crowds is going to start a tumult. It's going to raise a ruckus, if you will. And the Romans are going to have to do something about that. And they may take away the freedoms that they've allowed us to follow with our religion and follow with our law and such. They may just take it all away and we won't have any power at all. And it really gets to the heart of their unbelief. It's not that they lacked evidence, and it's not that they didn't know even. The way they're reacting shows that they have some measure of understanding, not belief, not faith, but understanding of who Jesus is and what he came to do. And because of that, they want to kill him. Because they don't want the Messiah, at least not the Messiah of who Jesus is. They want power. They want a significant place. And they're worried that the Romans will take that away. In verse 49, Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year, he said to them, "You know nothing at all, nor do you consider that it is expedient for us that one man should die for the people and not that the whole nation should perish." So Caiaphas almost speaks with arrogance and contempt for the other members of the Sanhedrin. They're worried. And Caiaphas, he's thinking, you know, I got it all together. You don't know anything, okay? It's expedient for us that even though this man hasn't really done anything wrong, and they know that, they know that. At least deep down, they know that Jesus is innocent. As much as they'll suggest that he sinned by healing people on the Sabbath and such, they know that's a strict interpretation by their tradition and not the Sabbath law. And they know Jesus has done nothing wrong. They've been trying to trip him up this whole time. They haven't been able to. They know he's innocent. But what Caiaphas is thinking is that even though he's innocent, it's expedient for us to kill him anyway, at least so that we have our power. And that's exactly what he's intending to do. Don't be worried and you know, you're showing your ignorance. We're in this position of power. And even though he's innocent, we can kill him so that we preserve the nation. And he speaks that almost as if there is a facade of care for the nation. But in reality, all he cares about is his power. It's a political statement. It's okay to perform or provide for a miscarriage of justice if it means I get to stay in power. That's what Caiaphas is saying. But there's something interesting that John comments on by inspiration in verse 51. "Now this he did not say by his own authority, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the nation, and not for that nation only, but also that he would gather together in one the children of God who are scattered abroad." In other words, Caiaphas thought he was speaking by his own volition here. And he certainly had a different idea of what these words meant, and he was speaking with evil motives. But God was speaking through him. He was using Caiaphas as a prophet. This tells us about inspiration. Caiaphas here, even though he might have thought he had control, had no control over what he was saying because he was saying it as a prophet. The reality is it would be expedient that Jesus would die so that none of us would have to die. That's what John was recording here. Jesus' death would be helpful to the extent that countless lost souls would not have to be lost for forever. He died so that we don't have to. That's what is being said. And he died not only for the Jews, but for all else as well. In chapter 10 and verse 16, he mentioned how he had sheep that were not of this fold. In chapter 12, he says, if I'm lifted up, I'll draw all peoples to myself. He died for not just the Jews, but for the Gentiles as well. So very interesting point of history that Caiaphas spoke in prophecy without even knowing it. In verse 53, it says, then from that day on, they plotted to put him to death. Therefore, Jesus no longer walked openly among the Jews, but went from there into the country near the wilderness to a city called Ephraim, and there remained with his disciples. It's not that he was afraid, but it wasn't yet his time. And it's interesting, he's not walking openly among them because he knows that if he does, then he's going to be arrested and put to death. It's not that he's afraid, though. It's not yet time. He's been talking about it this whole time. It's not yet time. It's not my time. And that's why they couldn't take me. In chapter 12, he's going to come in the most open fashion you could think of in the triumphal entry. And as we'll see in chapter 12, it's going to make them all the more angry. And that will ultimately get the ball rolling to his crucifixion. Verse 55, it explains that the Passover of the Jews was near. This is that Passover where Jesus would institute the Lord's Supper and then be crucified. This is nearing the last week of his ministry, of his life. And many went from the country up to Jerusalem before the Passover to purify themselves, sometimes more than a week early. And so they're looking for Jesus at this time, and he's not there yet. He's not coming that early. They sought Jesus and spoke among themselves as they stood in the temple. What do you think, that he will not come to the feast? And so they're wondering, is he coming? They want him to come to arrest him and kill him. And so this is what they did. This is the measure they took. It's not just them that's looking for him, but everyone. It says, both the chief priests and the Pharisees had given a command that if anyone knew where he was, he should report it that they might seize him. And so we see how volatile things are getting, how much tension there is. Jesus' life is coming to a close end. Although in John, we still have quite a few chapters to get through before we get to the crucifixion of Jesus.